he went down to the store and bought more. Sometimes he let his heap of dirty clothes get too big. And Jesus, did they stink sometimes. But the one time George teased him about it, Peter looked so embarrassed, and George felt terrible. He went up to the laundromat that very night with his drawstring laundry bag and a book, insisting that had been his plan all along. He hadn't known a thing about laundry when he first moved in, but George had shown him, and the women at the laundromat had shown him, and now he could treat and soak and press and fold like a 1950s housewife. George wondered if he still felt like a guest in the apartment or if he'd come to think of it as his home. He'd never even asked to put up a poster or a picture. It struck George now that he should have told him it was okay anyway, just in case. "It was fun," Peter said, tossing his bag on the back seat. He'd stayed with a group of sophomore runners, and he'd gotten the same impression he'd gotten at all the schools he visited, that the students were performing for him a little. These particular students spent part of the night talking about a time the year before when they'd all gotten drunk and shaved their heads. They'd asked Peter his best times, about where he'd placed in sectionals, at states. When they heard his times, they grew quiet. One asked why the hell he was thinking about running for Elliott. "But," Peter said as George merged into traffic, "I think maybe I should stay in New York. It was fun, for a night, but I was thinking I might take a year or two off before college. Figure out all the financial stuff." He thought, though he'd not mentioned it to anyone yet, not Coach Bell nor Ms. Carcara, that he could work with the ironworkers for a year or two, bank the money, and then go to a top school without having to take on so many loans. George was quiet for a long time. He wondered if it was about the boy's mother. Peter hadn't seen her since she was moved upstate. Anne didn't want to see him, but George could tell that the boy didn't know she'd made it official, that she'd refused to put her son's name down on the list of visitors. In fact, she didn't put a single name on the list. George didn't know whether he should just tell him now or wait until he made plans to go, and then either talk him out of going or drive him up there so he'd be with him when he got turned away. The Capital District Psychiatric Center had stricter protocols, was run much more like a prison than the hospital in Westchester had been. Maybe it comforted Peter in some way to live in the same state as she did, even if he didn't see her. Then George wondered if it was him Peter worried about, that he'd be lonely or something. He tried to think about how he'd see this decision from where Peter was standing, that maybe to a kid who'd been dealt the cards Peter had, it was more important to stay put in a place. Who knew? At 18, a boy can only see forward and can't imagine looking back. Then George thought of his brother and felt rage settle in his body. For years now, he'd been scrolling through his memories to find evidence that Brian was capable of this titanic degree of selfishness. At the exact moment the boy needed him most, he'd looked at a picture of a golf course and taken off. The cornfields and peach orchards of central New Jersey rolled out behind them in the rearview mirror. Peter, who hadn't been expecting an answer anyway, stared out the window with his chin on his fist. By the time George spoke, they'd wound through all the local roads and were merging onto the parkway. "Hey, Peter, I'm not your father. I know that. But in my humble opinion, you don't take a chance like this, then you're a real dummy." George had just started worrying about college, believing all that didn't get decided until the end of senior year. Here it was only fall. He'd been meaning to tell Peter that he'd help him however he could, but when he talked to the accountant the union used to organize retirement benefits, just for a little advice, it seemed like the only practical help he could give Peter was to co-sign for a loan. And, privately, George knew that probably wouldn't be possible, not with his credit. He'd been chipping away at it, doing all the things he should have done years earlier so that Brenda would have stayed, but it wouldn't happen soon enough to help Peter. Peter felt the blood rush to his cheeks. "What? Are you a smart kid, Pete? Like all these people say you are? Or are you dumb-dumb? Are you really asking? Which are you?"
"I'm a smart kid?"
"Yeah, you are. Now use the brain God gave you."
10.
It was Francis who decided they should have a party. All in 1 week the cold ended and the heat began, and they talked as they did every year about how that's not the way the seasons used to work. The day he thought of a party, they'd open the windows of the house to let the air in, and ended up keeping them open while they slept. Kate went to school in a sweatshirt on a Monday, and by Friday, she was wearing some thin thing with straps as narrow as shoelaces, and he asked her if it was meant for under another shirt, like a... But he got caught up on the word bra, and she knew it, cracked a wide, delighted grin. "It's a tank top, Dad," she said. "It's fine." "It doesn't seem like enough," he said, but she was still laughing and didn't listen. He was too busy to notice these things with Natalie and Sarah, but now he was not busy. It was like he'd stepped through a hinged door, and on one side his life was made up of rushing, rushing, rushing to get in the shower, to run a razor down his cheeks, to get a cup of coffee, through traffic, through paperwork, to a meeting, to another meeting, looking for a parking spot, arguing down the telephone, back into the car, out to find a perp, out to make an arrest, back into the car, back to the coffee pot, over and over and over. And now there was mostly silence. The flap of a bird going by in the morning, the rumble of the garbage truck making rounds, the tulips he'd planted as bulbs before Halloween, now pushing through the hard earth like a row of green blades. The party would be for Lena, really, though he suggested it for Kate's graduation. "You?" Lena said. "You, Francis Gleason, are suggesting a party?" She seemed astonished, like he'd suggested a walk on the moon. And he wondered if all along he'd been a grumpier person than he realized. They could invite everyone, he said. All the girls' friends, all of Jefferson Street, the people they knew from St. Bart's, the people at the small local insurance company where Lena had been working full-time since the start of Kate's senior year. They could get a tent if weather was too much of a worry. They'd invite far more people than could fit in the house, and that would be half the fun of it. Something about sending Kate off to college felt to him like the beginning of a new time. Better or worse was still to be seen. But it would also be like a big thank you, he said, for the meals people brought and the help they gave and all the well wishes that had come his way over recent years. "We have thanked them," Lena said, studying him as was her habit now. "I would never have left it this long." She didn't often ask if he was feeling okay anymore, but the question was always there. "But I'd love to have a party. You're sure? It'll be expensive." "I'm sure. Invite everyone." They hadn't slept together in going on 2 years, and before that had been before he was hurt, another 2 years. He was home enough now to know this was the sort of thing discussed with an air of tragedy on daytime talk shows. But he couldn't find a way to bring it up to her unless he blurted it out over dinner or while they were watching the news, and that would only make everything worse. And anyway, the time for bringing it up had passed. Once, he'd gotten up out of his chair and walked over to the couch where she was reading and pulled the book out of her hands. Before, that's all it would have taken. But now, she'd looked up at him in confusion. "Are you okay?" she'd asked, reaching up for him to hand the book back to her. So he gave it back. 2 years was a bewildering length of time to think about in total, but it had slipped by day, week by week, month by month, until the time piled up and they got used to it. He'd never been a man who kept track of these things. They'd always just fallen into sex before, sometimes a few days in a row, sometimes not for a whole week. But it never mattered because they were always searching for ways back to each other. That last time, they'd been in their bedroom, morning, the girls at school, Francis sitting on the edge of the bed, Lena crouched at his feet. She'd been helping him with his socks because 2 years ago he still got spells of dizziness whenever he bent over. It was most likely the drugs, the doctor said, not something about his brain that hadn't recovered. She'd put her hand on his thigh to steady herself, and he'd drawn her up, drawn her closer. He put one hand on her warm neck, the other on the sliver of skin between the top of her skirt and the hem of her sweater. The longer he kept his hand on her bare skin, the more he remembered his old life, and for a few minutes it felt as if he could will himself back to that life, stroke by stroke, push by push. She made herself do it. He could feel it, but he didn't care. She didn't kiss him like she used to. She didn't touch his face. She just reached under her skirt, pulled down her underwear, and carefully, gingerly crawled forward so that she was on top of him. There was nothing to be afraid of, he told her then. But she'd gotten so used to caring for him and worrying about him that it reminded him of what she'd been like when the girls were toddlers, when she spent her days clearing paths, following them up the stairs. He hadn't seen her fully naked since before he was shot. She'd begun changing in the bathroom. In the cooler months, she climbed into bed each night in head-to-toe plaid, her face scrubbed clean. In the summer, she wore a t-shirt that came nearly to her knees. She was considerate, more considerate than she used to be. Now, she'd never ask for the light to read by if she thought he might be drifting off to sleep. That one time, the last time, once he'd finished, she leaned forward and pressed her forehead to his. She didn't try to coax him to keep going, and that's when he knew she'd done it only for him and not at all for herself. Lena, love, he'd said when he realized she was crying, and tried to catch hold of her hands. But she stood up, shimmied her underwear back on, went into the bathroom, and ran the water for a few minutes, and then she went downstairs. Since then, he'd waited for a sign that something would flare between them again, and sometimes when she bobbed her hips along with the music coming from the kitchen radio, or curled the phone cord around her finger while she talked, a longing opened up in his chest like a blossom. Everyone told him how lucky he was, and he knew they weren't wrong. She'd tended to him from the very first moment the shot rang out and refused to leave his side. In those early weeks before he could walk, she never let him be. She was always taking a limb in her hands and massaging him so that he wouldn't get a clot. She fed him and kept him warm and smeared Vaseline on his lips and checked his IV and his wound site. And when she didn't like what a nurse or doctor told them, she asked to speak to another. "You'll be fine," she repeated to him over and over and over, and because of her, he never doubted it. But now, he could see, she'd gotten too used to being the caretaker and him the patient. She no longer went pale every time he made for the stairs, but she'd placed him in a category alongside the girls, the mortgage, another thing to worry about. In most ways, he was back to himself. It had taken a full 4 years, but he'd finally arrived more or less where he began, minus an eye and with some paralysis in the muscles of his face. One side of his body grew tired more quickly than the other. A run-of-the-mill head cold always felt to him like an infection. But he began taking up the odd jobs he'd done before. He began mowing the lawn again. He trimmed their trees and bushes and hauled the dead brush to the curb. When he worked hard, he sweat. And when a drop of sweat dripped from his brow down his face, it felt completely different on the left side than it did on the right. He shoveled the snow when it fell, and seeded the lawn in the spring and fall, and he soldered the basement pipe that had been weeping for years. When he hung the Christmas lights along the roof line, Lena held the ladder and scolded him the whole time that he shouldn't be up there, that it wasn't worth it. What if he got dizzy? That he'd better come down that instant. But he'd done it, and it was all fine. And still, they couldn't seem to fight their way back to each other. Not once since he came home from the hospital did she roll up against him in her sleep. Not once did she slide her hand across his chest like she used to and settle there. When he thought about it too much, he felt like a child for letting it bother him. "Hug me!" Kate had shouted at Lena once as a little girl. Someone's German shepherd had gotten loose and had chased the kids around the block, trying hard to nip their heels through his muzzle. Terrified, Kate had run inside. "Hug me!" she demanded of Lena, opening her little arms. Lena, smiling, had hugged her tight. Once in a while, at night, He tested himself against her boundary to see what might happen, but it was getting more difficult all the time. Just the other night, he'd run his fingertip along the ends of her hair, which was hanging in a sheet over the edge of her pillow. A whisper-like touch in the dark. All she had to do was not move, and he might have tried something bolder. "Sorry," she said, her back to him, and quickly flicked her hair out of his way. "Are you okay?" she asked over her shoulder. But now Kate was leaving, and the house would be theirs again. He could barely believe how quickly it had happened. For 20 years they'd been talking about putting on an addition, maybe, like so many neighbors had done, but then they'd looked up and discovered they didn't need it anymore. Used to be he'd come home from work and shout at everyone to pick up their markers, their papers, their sweatshirts, their backpacks. And then one day he'd looked around, and there were no backpacks thrown anywhere. And during the day now there wasn't even Lena. She worked at the insurance company from 9 to 5, and when she came home, she went straight to the kitchen, started chopping and boiling something for dinner. As a young man, as a young father, he'd never imagined there'd be a time when he'd be alone in his house every day. He thought about Ireland more and more, tried to remember if there was ever a day in his life when his own father didn't have something to do. Sometimes he kept the TV on for company, and one day as he was flipping through, he came upon a scene where a woman and a man were kissing in what looked to be a hotel room. He stayed on the channel. Next thing, just as the man began to undress the woman, he turned her around, pushed her onto the bed, and entered her from behind. Francis was never one for porn, but this was different. It was cable. He couldn't actually see anything, just the suggestion of something. Watching, he slid his hand inside his pants and touched himself until he came. And that started a stretch of months that reminded him of being 14 again, disappearing to a remote field where he could curl up and slip his hand inside his pants in privacy, because there was no place to be alone in the crowded house. He still took a painkiller every day, and when his doctor said that one pill likely did very little for him at this point, he understood that as permission to take two. Sometimes 2 in the morning and another 2 in the afternoon. Nothing seemed to happen except that he felt quiet in his center, at peace. He took an antidepressant, which didn't work nearly as well as 2 painkillers, and which felt a little embarrassing, but which his doctor said was standard. Sometimes, still, when he was standing at the kitchen sink looking out the window, he would hear the buzz and slap of a grass edger and expect to see Brian Stanhope's head moving along the other side of the rocks. Then he'd remember and feel astonished all over again. He tried to recall what he used to think of Anne Stanhope. He'd mostly wanted to stay out of her way. Otherwise, he hadn't thought much about her. She was an odd bird, that was all. A person they'd have to encounter for a little while, but could one day, when the kids were gone, ignore. He'd been kind to her. He'd been kinder than anyone else would have been. And still. Sometimes he let his imagination wander, and he placed Kate on their front porch instead of himself. What if she'd killed his child? He knew she'd been moved to a different hospital. It was generous of him to have agreed to the plea deal that removed her from prison, and sometimes he felt that generosity warranted more acknowledgement. If he were a different person, a vengeful person, he would have insisted on prison, and he knew what happened to crazy people in prison. He was worried when their lawyer called that he was going to tell them she'd been released to a halfway house or some nonsense, but it sounded as if the new hospital was not as nice as the first, and Francis was pleased. He tried to examine his pleasure. What did it mean about him? As Lena had asked many times, what did it matter, really, where she was, as long as she wasn't near them? But at the end of these examinations, he always concluded he was within his rights to wish ill upon her. He would have been captain by then. He would have been captain or better. And if things had gone as they should have when he walked into his house at the end of a day, his wife would look at him in a way she hadn't looked at him in 4 years now. Once a cop, always a cop, the guy said when they visited. But the more they said it, the less it rang true. It occurred to Lena as she began to gather the bottles of soda, the cases of beer, the chips, the dips, the pounds of ground beef for burgers, box after box of macaroni for salad, the gas for the grill, that this was how she'd once pictured living in Gillam. She'd seen herself hosting parties, throwing open their doors, and inviting in anyone who wanted to come. She'd pictured music playing, bottles uncorking. She'd pictured sitting outside with friends and neighbors while the kids raced around the house. She'd selected a dining table with double leaves instead of the usual single, because she imagined she'd need seating for 12 one day, even if that meant the table would extend right out of the dining room and into the living room. But when she brought the dining table leaves down from the attic, she noticed they were a slightly different color now than the table. The dowels were still covered in manufacturer's plastic. She'd called for Francis to take one end of each. They were too heavy to move on her own, and as he shuffled backward, he staggered for a moment. "Pick up your feet," she cried, and then insisted on switching sides. Graduation was on a Saturday. Kate had won the science prize and had to cross the stage to accept a certificate and shake the principal's hand. Natalie had graduated from Syracuse the previous week, and Sarah was halfway through SUNY Binghamton. With Francis's pension and Lena's job and a few loans, there would be enough to cover Kate's first year of tuition. Lena had assumed she would go to a state school like Sarah, but Francis was the one who noticed the brochures and envelopes from NYU coming in. "You want to go here?" he asked her one night after taking in the mail. She was eating a bowl of cereal before bed. Lena had already gone upstairs. He thought of the Ninth Precinct and of Brian Stanhope, of all people. A field mouse of a thought that shot through his brain and disappeared. Kate shrugged, and it broke his heart a little to see she'd become a girl who wouldn't say what she wanted. "If you had your pick of any school, which would it be?" He was determined to make her say it. "Well, we can't do private, right?" "This is a dream scenario, Kate. Which is it?" Finally, she nodded to the envelope in his hands. "You can get in?" he asked. "I think so." "So apply, and then we'll see." The party started at 3, and most of the guests arrived at exactly the same time. Some rang the doorbell before walking around the side of the house. Others just followed the sound of the stereo and trudged through the side yard bearing flowers, wine, platters of cookies, and pies. He couldn't remember how people used to greet him before he was hurt, but now they seemed to make a special point of it, and he wondered if talking with him made them feel virtuous, like they'd done a good deed. He could tell that most people had trouble looking at his mismatched pupils. Their own perfectly synchronized eyes would dart back and forth between his as they decided which one to settle on. Most people had presents for Kate, and when Francis saw that, he felt guilty. He hadn't pictured people going out to buy presents on top of everything else they'd done for them. But Kate accepted everything gladly, and when he looked at her across the patio, he was reminded of what she'd been like as a little girl, running a private inventory of her gifts as they came in. Her friends greeted her with hugs, and the boys in the class hung around the girls in a loose circle, long-armed and mostly shy. He fired up the grill at 4 and began lining the grate with burgers, hot dogs, foil-wrapped corn on the cob. He had a beer, 2 beers, 4 beers. He refilled the coolers. A few men kept him company, while the women mostly clustered around the appetizer table. At one point, Lena led a group of women upstairs to look at their bedroom closet and get advice on what could be done. She was delighted to be hosting. And when her voice carried over to him, it sounded giddy and girlish. She'd made pitchers of margaritas, and when they went in the first hour, she brought out all the bottles that had gone into them and a pile of limes and mixed up more. They ate more, drank more, and still, people kept arriving, Francis kept grilling. There were other graduation parties that day, and some of their guests hopped from one to the next until it felt like all of Gillam was one big party. A woman came up and asked Francis if she could get a burger without cheese, and while she waited, she asked him how he was doing, if he still got those sharp pains around his orbital wall. He turned to her quickly, and she smiled, put her hand on his arm. "You don't remember me. I just started at Broxton around the time you were moved there. I wasn't on your floor, but I came in to see you because our girls were in school together."
"I do remember."
"Yes, of course."
She laughed.
"You don't, but you're very polite. You were getting a lot of visitors then. I remember a stream of cops in and out. Some of the young nurses used to put on lipstick in case any of them were single. They were sad when you were discharged."
"Ah, that would have been pertinent information at the time, I'm sure."
Francis took another look at her. She was petite, with long auburn hair and a pretty dress with flowers printed on it.
"You have a daughter in the high school? You look so young," he said, and blushed.
He hadn't meant to sound like he was flirting, but she did look young.
"I did until yesterday. Casey. Do you know Casey? She's..."
She turned and tried to find her.
"Well, she's here somewhere."
He put the burger on her plate, and she put her hand on his arm once more and squeezed. He felt a charge on his skin where she touched him.
"Good to see you looking so healthy,"
she said, and then she slipped off into a crowd of women talking by the shed. It was nearly dusk when he finally turned off the grill, and after dusk when he finally sat down. There were still more people arriving, and now, in the near dark, they snuck up on the crowd in the backyard like a jolt of new life. A local cop named Dowd was just telling him about a case when Kate came up behind Francis's chair and whispered that someone was puking by the rhododendron. They'd told the girls to be careful, to watch their friends, but it was inevitable, he supposed. They should have been more strategic about where they put the coolers, but they figured it would be okay. Lena had pointed out that when they were 18, it was legal to drink. The law was arbitrary, and at their age, Francis had been on his way to America, for God's sake. Plus, most of the teenagers at the party had a parent there, too. He excused himself as he crossed the yard. He looked around for Lena, who must have gone inside. Someone had found a pack of cards, and as he passed the kitchen window, he saw a group of men sitting around his table as Oscar Maldonado dealt. Some of the wood chairs from inside had somehow gotten outside, and the chaise longue from outside was now in the middle of the kitchen. Kate had an urgent expression on her face and walked quickly ahead of him. When he turned the corner, he expected a crowd of people, but it was the dark side of the house, the side that didn't lead to the driveway, and once he arrived at the bush where Kate stopped walking, it felt like the party was far away. "How much did she have?" he asked Kate.
"I don't know. I just saw her going around this side of the house, so I followed her."
He had to squint into the shadows to spot the figure on all fours, her hair hanging around her face.
"Okay, I'll take care of it," he said, feeling mostly sober all of a sudden.
"And Kate, that's it for all of you. Unless a kid is with his or her own parent, not a single person under the age of 25 leaves this house without me getting a look at them. Got it?"
"Got it," Kate said, but then she gave him a look before she jogged away.
He went down on one knee and gathered the person's hair in his fist. She retched for several seconds, the volume and drama of which didn't match what little came out.
"Okay, okay," he said and patted her on the back. "Let's get you cleaned up."
He took firm hold of her upper arms and helped pull her to standing.
"Oh,"
he said when he saw who it was.
"I'm so embarrassed,"
she said as she swayed back and forth. She was barefoot, and one strap of her dress had fallen down around her elbow. She leaned for a moment against his chest and closed her eyes. When he felt the steady rhythm of her breathing, he knew that she'd fallen asleep. Her hair smelled like tea. Her frame was smaller than Lena's. He pushed her away, gently.
"Sorry, You said your name is... I forgot to ask before. But she slid her hands up his arms, clutched his shoulders, and he couldn't understand what she said.
Oh, poor thing. That's Joan Kavanaugh, Lena said when she came looking for Francis and saw whom he was leading around the side of the house. The card game was still going strong around the kitchen table, but Lena squeezed by the men to bring out a glass of water and two aspirin, which Francis dropped into Joan's mouth one at a time. Lena was in bad shape herself, and after asking twice if he could handle it, she went upstairs to lie on their bed with all her clothes on, including her sandals. Joan's daughter had already left, thank God. She'd walked to another party with a group of half a dozen other kids. "Is she all right?" Kate asked, and Frances realized that she'd hung back and let all her friends go on without her. Sarah was upstairs. Who knew where Natalie had gone off to, but she was an adult now, a college graduate.
"She drank too much," Kate said.
It was so obvious that Joan Kavanaugh had drank too much that Kate's statement, framed with cautious certainty, betrayed her innocence. He could see that up until that hour she thought drinking too much was just for kids.
She might have eaten something bad. Who knows?
Kate looked at the woman for a long time as if deciding.
Well, she can sleep here, can't she? You won't make her go home.
No, I won't make her go home, but she might like to wake up in her own house. But then he thought of the next problem. Do you know where the Kavanaughs live?
Kate shook her head. One of those blocks by the playground, I think?
She glanced down at her friend's mother as if to make sure she wasn't listening.
I think it's just her and Casey who live there. I'm not sure. I think the dad doesn't live there anymore.
Frances contemplated the sleeping stranger, curled up now with a beach towel over her shoulders for warmth. She was snoring softly with her mouth open.
I'll sort it out, Katie. Okay? You go on up to bed.
How long had they been out there? One by one, without his noticing, every guest had left. The kitchen was dark except for the light above the stove. Francis went in and pulled the throw blankets from the couch and armchair. He turned off the TV, which was blaring music videos. When he came back outside, he pushed two armchairs together until they faced each other, and used one to sit in and the other to put up his feet. He draped one blanket over Joan and wrapped the other around himself. He was drunk, he realized, as he stared at a group of moths darting and swooping under the porch light. He was drunk, and he was exhausted. He tried to remember meeting Joan at Broxton, but it was too tiring to recall, and he decided he'd do the work of remembering tomorrow. When he woke into the blue chill of morning, she was looking at him over the edge of her blanket. In the space between their chairs were a few stained napkins, a sea of crushed potato chips.
"I'm mortified," she whispered.
It was not quite dawn, and his neck felt stiff and frozen. The inside of his mouth felt like fur. She stood and neatly draped the blanket he'd given her over the back of the chair where she'd slept.
"I'm leaving," she whispered. "I'm walking home. You should go inside."
She took a moment to look around for her shoes, and when she found them, she just hooked them on her first two fingers. As she passed by, he reached out and grabbed her free hand, held tight. Twisting around in his chair, he moved his hands to her hips, then up to the narrowing at her waist, and for a second, for only half a second perhaps, he felt her move closer to him, her muscles tensing under his palms. The morning felt thin and breakable, and if he asked her a question, he knew it would lead to another, and that one to another, and so on.
"I'm going," she said, and then she was gone.
11. George went down to Skillman to play basketball while Peter packed. He'd planned on helping, but that morning when they were standing at the couch shoulder to shoulder, folding Peter's few clothes into piles, they realized it wasn't a job for two. In early August,
George took him to a Sears on Long Island where he bought Peter a set of bath towels and new, extra-long, blue and red plaid sheets for his dorm room bed. George asked what else he needed, and Peter knew some kids were getting small refrigerators, 13-inch televisions, but he said nothing. All his meals were included. What else could there be? On the way home, they stopped at their usual diner, and George cleared his throat and said that since his dad wasn't there, it was up to him to tell Peter a few things before he headed into the world on his own. And Peter felt his stomach drop. Sure, George was going to say something about sex that Peter already knew but didn't want to know that George knew, too. Once, Peter had a bad head cold and left practice. He arrived home 2 hours early and believed, at first, that George wasn't home. Then he heard sounds coming from the bedroom, small movements, a quick, hushed conversation. He froze, his keys still in his hand, and then he left again. He walked down Queens Boulevard towards Manhattan's skyline. When he got as far as the movie theater, he turned around. When he returned home a second time, there was no one in the apartment and George's bedroom door stood wide open. Instead, George said that he knew there was a lot of drinking that went on in college and that might be okay for the other kids, but not for Peter.
I mean, a little, sure. A few beers here and there. But you've probably got the gene, Peter. Some people have it and some people don't. If you're like the Stanhopes, then you have it.
George had been making references to the gene for a few years now, but Peter didn't know if he meant a real gene, as in a distinct sequence of nucleotides that formed part of a chromosome, or if it was just a notion invented by people who needed to understand themselves.
Did my dad have a problem? In that way, I mean?
George gaped at him.
Oh, Peter. Buddy. Yes.
I never noticed.
Well, George said, you were a kid.
I don't think so. I would have noticed, and I didn't.
Okay.
Peter removed his napkin from his lap and refolded it along the seams. He went to the bathroom, washed his hands without looking at his reflection in the mirror, and when he got back to his seat, he made himself eat 2/3 of the burger so that George wouldn't ask why he wasn't hungry. Instead of packing his suitcase with his running t-shirts and thermals, Peter put his books in there because they were the heaviest and the suitcase had wheels, and George said that was the sort of thinking that got him the big bucks. He stuffed his clothes into his old track duffel. Since he'd worn a uniform through high school, he only had one pair of jeans, a few sweaters, 2 pairs of khaki shorts. He went through his running clothes, and anything with yellowed armpits he stuffed in a giant hefty bag and then carried down to the trash can on the curb. Already, the space he'd taken up for 4 years was emptying of his presence, and he could begin to see how the place would close up around any memory of him, like the walling up of a door. His classmates' graduation parties were spread across the summer, and Peter had gone to most of them, though at each of these parties, he always wondered why he'd come. Every one of them was an incongruous mingling of friends and elderly aunts and oddball neighbors, all of whom had different ideas of what to expect from such gatherings. Peter grinned for group photos, but he knew when the pictures were developed that the reluctance would be clear on his face, and that made him never want to see them. At one party, Henry Finley's parents had gotten a keg they told Henry was full of Budweiser. But it turned out to be full of O'Doul's, and the adults laughed at the kids who pretended to have gotten drunk. At the same party, his friend Rowan asked him if he ever saw that old girlfriend of his anymore.
Once in a while, Peter said. Not often.
But you're still into her, Rowan said. That explains why you never came to hang out with the girls from Higgins.
Did that explain it? Peter wondered. He had to report to Elliot for cross-country practice, which began a week before freshman orientation, then classes would start. At graduation, he had thought, maybe, you never knew, maybe he'd look over and see his father at the back of the gym, or his mother with 2 orderlies next to her, a van running outside at the curb. And 3 months later, on the day he lifted his suitcase and his duffel into the trunk of George's car, he had the same feeling. like his parents might come walking quickly down the street, afraid they would miss the chance to say goodbye. Sometimes it seemed like a lifetime since he'd seen either of them. On the night before he left, George took him to eat at an Italian restaurant in the city, and over dinner he told a story about a man he knew a long time ago who couldn't do the thing that was right, and the longer he waited to do it, the more difficult it became. But it didn't mean the man didn't want to do it. It was a parable, Peter realized, and gave up trying to follow. "It's okay, George," Peter said. "I know what you're trying to tell me." The next afternoon, after checking out Peter's dorm and walking around campus for a while, George handed Peter an envelope and said it was time for him to take off. Peter clapped his uncle on the shoulder, shook his hand. "Well, thanks for everything," he said. His chest hurt.
"Hey, hey,"
George said, pulling Peter in for a tight hug.
"Don't look so worried, okay? You always look so goddamn worried, Peter. It's all good stuff, okay? I'll see you at Thanksgiving. That's no time at all."
Several hours later, Peter remembered the envelope, which he'd shoved into the pocket of his shorts. Inside were 5 stiff $100 bills. Practices weren't much different than those under Coach Bell, and Peter saw immediately that he was the best on the team. He wasn't used to practicing with girls, with the women's team, as Coach called it. Not that the men and the women saw much of each other once they finished warm-ups. He liked that no one knew anything about him except that his name was Peter Stanhope, that he came from Queens, that he ran the fastest 800 meter in the city the previous spring. No, he didn't have a girlfriend. No, he didn't know his major yet. His parents? Yeah, they split a few years back. His mom lived in Albany now. Yeah, he saw her when he could. On the third day of practice, one of the seniors on the girls' team said something about having been home for the summer, back to her hometown of Riverside, which bordered Gillam. Peter calculated. She would have been a junior at Riverside High when everything happened. For the rest of the week, he made sure to stretch on the opposite side of the circle, to drop his head in case she might turn to look at him when Coach called out his name. But when she didn't seem to recognize him or his name, he felt the heavy cloak of worry he'd been wearing grow lighter, until it was as if he'd simply shrugged it off his shoulders and let it fall to the ground. Little by little, he felt the shiver of a new idea forming, a new space opening up wide enough for him to stand in. Friday was move-in day for the rest of the freshmen, and Peter left a note for his roommate to say that although he'd already chosen a bed, a dresser, he didn't mind switching. The first note he wrote seemed too formal, so he tore it up. The second draft seemed too brusque. So in his third draft, he added a few exclamation points, and only a few minutes later, when he was crossing the quad, did he worry that exclamation points might seem kind of gay. All week, he'd been looking at the proximity of the two beds in his room, trying not to think about the fact that he'd never, not even in George's apartment, lived in such close quarters with another human being. He didn't know if his habits were normal, if he was too neat or too messy, if he was too quiet or too loud. When a person should ignore one's roommate in order to grant a sort of false privacy, or if it was better and less weird to always acknowledge the other person and try to keep up light conversation. And would that be possible if they were to sleep and study and hang out all in the same 10-by-12-foot space? Wouldn't conversation run out by Halloween? He'd known for a long time now that his tendency to be careful was part of what kept him apart. The guys on the team showered after practice and walked around in their underwear and laughed at each other's privates and then went on to eat together, play video games. That night, not long after the last of the parents had kissed their darlings goodbye, a ritual Peter had been observing all around him, all day long, there was a late summer storm that brought down branches, pried power lines from the sides of buildings. When his dorm lost power, his roommate, Andrew, a husky guy from Connecticut whose first words to Peter were, "What are you listening to right now? Hip-hop? Metal? Don't say country," kept saying that his mother should have packed candles, his mother should have packed a flashlight,
He couldn't understand why she hadn't. So Peter told him to come on, and they gathered in the common area with the other freshmen who'd just moved in. Peter suggested they have a scavenger hunt in the dark, and for the first time in a while, he thought of Kate. Thought about how much she'd have loved that idea. He wondered where she was at that moment. He tried to imagine what he'd do or say if he showed up to his first class, and there she was, sitting with her notebook open. Would he even recognize her? Would she be glad to see him? Or would she blame him for what happened? For his long silence? At orientation, Peter groaned along with the others at the corny icebreakers, the forced fun meant to bond them. He was grouped with three other freshmen for a trust exercise, and the leader had barely finished explaining the instructions when the blonde girl in his group was literally falling into his arms.
"You almost dropped me," she said.
"I wasn't ready," he said, defensive. After, the other boy in their group said, "Dude, she was flirting." When orientation was over, all that was left to do was buy books, register for classes. Peter headed to the main campus bookstore one morning and had to stop in the crosswalk for a bus to pass by, the words 41st Street Terminal lit up above the front windshield. He stopped walking and stared at it until he realized a car was waiting for him to cross. The next day, the bus was there again. The driver pulled into the wide cul-de-sac outside the bookstore just before 9. What started as a stray thought began to take shape. The upperclassmen were arriving now in droves, taking up all the picnic tables and grassy spaces of the quad, and on the day before classes were set to begin, Peter climbed the steps of the bus and confirmed the destination was Manhattan. It was an express, the driver said. He stopped at another college in New Jersey, then two park and rides along the turnpike, and then the Port Authority bus terminal. Peter patted his back pocket and felt for his wallet, and then he climbed aboard. He didn't bring a book or a magazine. He didn't tell his roommate or his coach or his RA. He refused to ask himself what he was doing. It was a Tuesday morning in September 1995, the day after Labor Day, and the roads were empty. From the Port Authority, he took the subway one stop to Penn Station. He approached the first Amtrak teller he found. The train he wanted was departing in 14 minutes. It was mid-afternoon by the time he got to Albany. From the Rensselaer station, he took a taxi to the hospital, but he was too anxious to go in right away, so he walked a lap around the entire complex, and then he sat on a bench and tried to calm down. All day, all week, all summer, he'd felt in himself a weather vane swinging around wildly to face one direction and then another whenever the wind blew. Now, here, he'd settle things. Face the chill he'd felt between his shoulder blades for 4 years. Tell his mother he loved her no matter what and find out if she loved him too. When he felt more ready, he told the man at reception who he was, whom he wanted to see. He'd gotten a Coke out of a vending machine at the train station and had clutched it all through the taxi ride and as he walked across the hospital grounds. He was afraid if he opened it now, it would explode. So he set it on the narrow ledge that ran along the bottom of the reception window while the man squinted at his computer screen. "First time visiting?" the man asked. Before Peter could answer, he said, "No cameras, recording devices, tobacco products, drugs, drug paraphernalia. That includes prescription medication, insulin pens, syringes. No weapons, chemicals, personal property, including keys or identification. No tapes or DVDs, no Walkman or headphones, no electric toothbrushes or electric razors, no metal cutlery, any beverage that has caffeine." At this, he glanced at Peter's Coke. "No solid-colored clothing or clothing with solid-colored patches. No paint, pens, highlighters, scissors, knitting needles, weights, magnetic devices." He let that sink in. "So," he said, "what do you have?"
"Nothing," Peter said. He dropped the unopened soda into the trash bin next to the desk, and it landed with a heavy thud. He was sweating so much that he was afraid to lift his arms in case there were rings there.
Can you repeat the patient's name?
The man leaned closer to his computer monitor. Peter did, and tried to read what it meant when the man pinched the bridge of his nose, closed his eyes tight, told Peter to take a seat because he had to call upstairs. Is there a problem?
Just take a seat.
A woman who was older than his mother was also waiting, and on her lap were two enormous bags of cookies. She had another clear Ziploc that held toothpaste, floss, plastic razor blades. He worried the razor blades would be taken from her. Peter was wearing a polo shirt, shorts. After a few minutes of waiting, he went into the grim men's room and used a wad of paper towels to wipe his forehead, his neck, under his arms. On his way back to his seat, he asked at the desk if they'd called his name while he was in the restroom. He waited another 40 minutes and watched other visitors get escorted through the double security doors. He watched through the murky windows as security guards lifted their bags to the light, went through them, and every once in a while plucked items out, set them aside. He went back up to the desk, and the man told him he had to wait longer. It was late afternoon already. Soon it would be dinner time. Would a patient be allowed to see a visitor during dinner? He listened to everything and tried to feel her presence in the building, some distant sound that he would know came from her. Whenever he pictured his mother, he always saw her alone in a room somewhere. He remembered a time years ago when she sat on the edge of his bed and told him about a rooster she once knew that crowed all day long, and how she thought it so strange, until she found out that almost all roosters crow through the day. It's only the sunrise crowing people notice, because the world is so quiet at sunrise.
But you notice the other crowing too?
He had said.
You're the only one?
I'm the only one, she said. Eventually, a buzzer sounded, and a sunken-eyed man with a hospital ID hanging around his neck stepped through the double doors and said Peter's name. The man put his hand on Peter's shoulder and led him over to a potted tree, an attempt at privacy.
I'm afraid your mother won't see you today, he said.
And Peter nodded vigorously, as if this were what he'd been expecting all along. They were willing to bend the rules a bit. Peter hadn't applied to be a visitor, hadn't gone through the requisite waiting period, but his mother simply wasn't up to it.
She isn't up to it, or she doesn't want to see me.
You might try again in a few weeks, the man said. You could arrange a particular date, give her some advance notice. That way she might prepare.
Is she doing well, though? What can you tell me?
Just try again. Register first. Go through the protocols. By then... But Peter tuned him out. He knew he would not be trying again in a few weeks. Something had carried him onto the bus that morning, and it wasn't a feeling that would come over him twice. Already, the journey back to his dorm room seemed impossibly long, and the return bus didn't even go all the way to Elliot. He'd have to disembark in the little town nearest to the college and then take a taxi. He thanked the man, and as he left the hospital, he hurried across the wide lawn. He walked as the crow flies, cutting through residential blocks, strip malls, parking lot after parking lot, keeping the skyline of the city center in front of him. He walked over a footbridge and past a bar where people were sitting quietly, watching something on television. Baseball. The strike had just ended. When Peter approached another bar, he decided to go in. Except for a bag of M&Ms on the train, he hadn't eaten since that morning. He sat at the end of the bar and ordered a soda and a plate of fries. Then, as soon as the bartender stepped away, Peter called him back and told him to make it a beer. He looked at the row of tap handles and picked one, though he didn't know one from another. The bartender didn't ask for ID, so when he finished that beer, he ordered another. Then one more after that. 3 pints of some kind of dark beer, heavy for a summer day, but once he made a choice, he thought he'd better stick with it. The only time the bartender seemed to be appraising him was when he handed over one of George's $100 bills.
He held the bill up to the light. Peter got to the train station with 20 minutes to spare. He felt warm, easy in his body, realized he might be a tiny bit drunk. He didn't know it would feel so cozy. "I know what I'm going to do," he said aloud, and made for the bank of telephones. He picked up a phone and pushed random coins through the slot until the dial tone went steady. Then, his finger poised over the pad, he realized he'd never called her. Not once, and didn't know her number. Why memorize her number when he could just stand outside and look up at her window? But he did know her address, just one digit different from his own. He returned to the newsstand, bought a small spiral notebook, a box of envelopes, a pen. They didn't sell stamps, but an elderly woman overheard his query and told him she'd sell him one for a quarter. He didn't want to think too much about what to write or what not to write, so he bent his head over the page and filled it with his scrawl. A list of stray thoughts, maybe, but ones that she would understand. He wrote about Queens, about George, about running, about the trouble he had making close friends. He wrote that he missed her, and had tried sending her telepathic messages a few times, years ago, and also how sometimes a week or two might go by without thinking of her. He told her that there were times he was certain that she hated him, and other times when he was certain she'd forgive him for everything that happened. He asked if she thought it was weird that he felt like he still knew her very well, and that she knew him, even though they hadn't seen each other in more than 4 years. He wrote that he'd like to see her. When he was finished, he tore out the pages and left the ripped bits along the side. He folded and stuffed them inside one of the envelopes, wrote her name and address on the outside. He'd passed a blue USPS mailbox on the sidewalk, 2 or 3 blocks from the station. He looked at the departures board and knew he'd make it. He ran like someone had a clock on him, pushing out the swinging doors and dodging commuters hustling toward him. He sprinted 2 blocks, crossed a street, and dropped the envelope into the mailbox. He was back on his train's platform in less than 3 minutes. For the whole journey home, the long 2-hour ride to Manhattan, and then another 2 hours back to Elliott, the bus's air conditioner blasting despite the mild evening, Peter thought of his letter to Kate sitting in the dark belly of that mailbox. He flipped through the spiral notebook where he'd torn the pages out, running his fingers over the blank top page as if it might help him recall what he'd written. He felt a few misgivings, but was still glad he'd done it, and he looked forward to what might happen next. By the 3rd hour, he was having trouble tamping down his panic. It had seemed like such a great idea in the moment, and he'd let that enthusiasm carry him. Now, he only felt ill. He tried to imagine George's voice in his ear, saying, "Peter, buddy, you worry too much." When he got off the bus, it was after midnight, and he stood alone on the lighted sidewalk, listening to the crickets of central New Jersey. The air smelled like peaches. And along the main road, there were signs for orchards everywhere, as many peaches as a person could pick. The houses lining the wide avenue were modest but sweet-looking, and Peter imagined the kids inside sleeping among their toys and their books, their ceilings dotted with glow-in-the-dark stars. In the distance, from the direction of the college, came the sound of car horns beeping, a call and an answer. He towed the edge of the circle of lamplight and fought the urge to howl, to wake all the people in all the houses. Instead, he crossed his arms tight across his chest and began the long walk back to campus. He should have been wilder, he thought. He should have been out roaming the streets of the city at night, no parents to tell him not to. He'd have had a ready excuse for any trouble he might have gotten into. He should have broken things, stolen things, listened to music so loud that the neighbors pounded on the door. He should have tried smoking pot when the other kids did. He should have tried coke that time Rowan had gotten hold of some. He should have followed the other boys when they filed into the bathroom of a Pizza Hut in Kew Gardens to see what it was like. He should not have hung back at the table, worried that their waiter would think they were skipping out on the bill. He should have found a girlfriend, multiple girlfriends,
one from one school and one from another like some of the other boys did, and then he should have smirked about it in homeroom. He should have been so wild that George would have had to hunt his father down and make him come back, so wild he would have had to get his mother's lawyer involved to figure out what could be done. But instead, he'd been so very good. He should have gotten on the commuter bus back to Gillam and gone to Kate. He should have broken down her door if they wouldn't let him see her. He should have at least stood on her front lawn and shouted her name. He stayed to the road's narrow shoulder, and when he saw car lights approaching, he stepped off into the shadows of trees until the car was safely past. Reaching his dorm room, he slid his key into the lock and turned the doorknob slowly, slowly, just in case Andrew was asleep. Two by two. 12. Dr. Abbasi put Anne's name in for case review at the end of her fourth year at Capital District Psychiatric Hospital. "What does that mean?" she asked, and heard a harsh edge in her voice that she hadn't intended. Dr. Abbasi was dark, Indian, maybe, or Pakistani. He started at CDPH during Anne's second year there. He had a posh British accent, hooded eyes, and a deadpan wit that surprised Anne the first few times she encountered it. He didn't seem as tired as the other doctors did. She wondered what he was like at home when he changed into his weekend clothes, what he did for fun. She had never, not once, wondered that about any of her other doctors. None of the other doctors ever made her feel hopeful about herself, about what might happen. He said, once, early on, "When this time in your life is behind you, Anne," and she lost track of what he was talking about because no one had ever referenced a time when all this might be behind her. It was as if a wall had been built between her real life and her life in the hospital, and that wall just kept growing taller and taller. And then Dr. Abbasi arrived with a catapult to help her over. "It means we're going to go over your case, your progress, and talk about whether you might be ready for the next step." "Which would be?" "An environment with more independence, but with support if needed. A residential re-entry center seems right to me, to start."
"A halfway house?" Anne said, and remembered with a pang a petition she'd signed years ago that sought to block the opening of a halfway house in Gillam.
"We're going to discuss several options."
"But chances are good that I won't pass the review." Right then, she ticked off in her head all the people who had been up for review since her arrival and were still there stirring powdered eggs around their breakfast plates each morning.
"I wouldn't say that. I only mention it because I don't want you to be taken by surprise if you do pass."
"But I probably won't. There are people who've been here 20 years, more."
"True, but I have a different perspective than some of my predecessors, and the thinking is changing surrounding this."
"This?"
"This." Dr. Abbasi gestured to the walls, the windows, widened his arms to take in the world. "You committed a crime."
"Yes,
but you were found not responsible due to your mental state at that time. You weren't taking your meds consistently, and what you were taking wasn't right for you. That's changed, Anne. You're doing very well. You'd still see a doctor as an outpatient, and your medications would have to be recalibrated from time to time, but it doesn't make sense that you be here longer than you would have spent in prison if you were found responsible for your actions. You're a good candidate. Start thinking about it."
Dr. Abbasi's arrival coincided with Peter's visit to the hospital. By the time Dr. Abbasi inherited her case from a doctor who was scaling back, Anne had been removed from all-group therapy. She'd been moved to the fifth floor. The first time she met Dr. Abbasi, he entered her room tentatively, politely, as if it were up to her to ask him to stay or go.
"I hear you've been having some trouble," he said.
He didn't carry a notebook or a clipboard. His hands were clasped behind his back.
"My son," Anne said, her voice cracking.
She knew they were watching her. She knew she must remain composed. That day, when a social worker came in and told her that her son was downstairs, that she would be allowed to see him if she wished, she felt Peter's energy move through the pipes that snaked secretly through the floors, made them hum and glow. The air immediately took on glints of silver and gold. She was certain she knew he was there several seconds before she was told. She hadn't been brave enough to see him that day, so she'd sent him away. Immediately after, she felt her internal clock speed up, a central agitation that always foretold a bad time. She tried to hide it by keeping her face placid and putting food in her mouth at meals, and sitting rigidly in the common space and not saying a single word lest she give herself away. But she knew they were studying her, and the quieter she made herself, the closer they looked. It was exhausting work to keep up. So, after a few days of this, when a nurse came to escort her to group, always group, endless group, everyone nattering on about every little thing while the planet spun and wars were won and lost, and Anne's own child was out there somewhere, an adult, hoping to see his mother. Anne saw lights, like fireflies, over the nurse's head. She began swatting at them. The nurse called for backup, claiming to have been attacked. Her history of violence was referenced. But what Anne hated more than being lifted physically, what she hated more than feeling a stranger's hot breath near her ear, what she hated more than being drugged or locked in a room, were the smirks on the faces of the other patients. While every other doctor at the hospital would have asked, "Why do you believe they were smirking at you?" Dr. Abbasi asked instead, "Why does their smirking bother you? Considering the other things you must know you have to face when they carry you away." "So you agree that they were smirking?" Dr. Abbasi paused to consider his answer. "I agree that human nature allows for that strong possibility. Yes." The day Anne learned she'd passed the review was a Tuesday, more than 2 years since Peter's visit. And by Friday morning, she was in a van, heading to a house on the edge of Saratoga County. She sat ramrod straight on the bench seat behind the driver, swallowing hard against the acid rising in her throat. She didn't say goodbye to anyone, didn't have anyone she'd call a friend, except a woman she sometimes sat near at meals. "Nice day," the driver said kindly, and glanced at her in the rearview mirror several times in quick succession. The sky was a dazzling blue, but the oily puddles that dotted the shoulder of the highway told her there had been recent rain. Dr. Abbasi had shaken her hand, and when she didn't let go, he put his other hand over hers, too. He wouldn't be getting into the van with her. He wouldn't be showing her around her new home. Rounding a back road in Malta, she glimpsed a white sail moving among the trees. The ocean was at least 200 miles away. "What's that?" she asked, squinting.
"What's what?" the driver asked.
"It looks like a sail."
"Day like today, boats are on the water by dawn."
"What water?"
"Lake Saratoga," the driver said. "Don't they tell you anything about where you're headed?"
Since addiction had never been part of Anne's pathology, she was free to look for nursing work again, and if she found a job quickly, she could enter immediately into phase two, which meant she could come and go freely, and also get out of mandatory vocational training. Irene House was just 30 miles north of the hospital, and the driver told her that made her lucky. Some people ended up in Buffalo or all the way downstate. Anne had heard terrible things about halfway houses. Several patients at CDPH had been in and out and told her to watch herself, watch her stuff. The experience was more dehumanizing than the hospital. And arriving at Irene seemed to match what she'd been warned about.
The house itself was a depressed-looking three-story box that sat too close to the sidewalk. The house director, a woman named Margaret, had shown her to her bedroom, which Anne would share with another resident, and when Margaret opened the door, Anne expected to glimpse a family of cockroaches scurrying every which way. Instead, the room was simple but clean, small but surprisingly bright, despite wall-to-wall carpet the color of moss. Margaret told her to go ahead and freshen up if she liked. Her roommate likely wouldn't be home until dinner time, and she handed Anne a key before stepping out and closing the door behind herself. A moment later, alone, Anne pushed the button lock on the door and then turned the knob so that it popped open again, over and over. Every time she pushed the button, she felt a thrill. She'd been there for only a few days when she got a job offer from an assisted living home for the elderly in Ballston. It was really a job for an aide. She wouldn't provide any medical care. But when she told her social worker, a wraith-thin woman named Nancy who had hair the color of shoe polish, that she'd decided to take it, Nancy had given her a look over the top of her glasses that told her she was lucky to have gotten it and should never imagine she could do better. She would help the elderly residents get bathed and dressed, bring them plastic cups of water with straws. Nancy said to be on guard for housemates who would figure out she had access to pills and to immediately tell her or Margaret if any of the other residents at Irene tried to strike a deal with her. The warning reminded Anne that she had to be careful about what she told people about both her present and her past. It was best not to say anything at all. Dr. Abbasi had told her that she might feel disoriented when she noticed different things that had changed since 1991, despite only 6 years having passed, despite having done all the field trips. Twice a year, the patients who were stable enough were brought in small groups to a mall or to a farmer's market or a beauty salon with an assignment to purchase a dozen tomatoes or ask for change of a 20. Even if Anne had been paying close attention on those trips, her doctor warned, she might feel differently once she was really out and had to participate. A few days before Anne started at the nursing home, she walked into a bank for the first time in more than 6 years and faced what little was left after the sale of the house in Gillam. "There hasn't been activity on this account since 1991, said the teller. Brian had long ago sold the house and her car to pay the legal fees, to pay the medical bills, and when it was all over, he split the remainder of their assets down the middle and deposited hers in her individual account. If he'd stuck by Peter, it would have been his right to take it, to pay for the things that Peter would need. But he hadn't stuck by Peter. Still, so many years later, when she stopped for a moment and tried to comprehend that he'd left her child, her boy, in an apartment in Queens with his idiot, alcoholic brother, she felt a physical weight on her rib cage, a striking pain where she knew her heart must be. They'd gotten him into that good high school, at least, and by the time she got to Irene House, he'd have finished at least a few years of college. She knew he was applying because the financial aid office of some college in New Jersey needed all sorts of paperwork to prove that Peter was no longer her dependent, to sever his financial ties to her. An assistant in her lawyer's office brought it all upstate for her to sign. After that, Anne liked to daydream about what he'd become one day. President of the United States was not out of the question. CEO of an international company, brain surgeon, university professor. She'd been told that her thoughts ran grandiose when she was entering a manic cycle, and so she tried to examine each prospect for him honestly, with the evidence at hand. But everything checked out. He was a smart boy. He was going to college. Brian was still her husband, as far as she knew, though he seemed more like an idea than a person, as removed from her as the family she'd left behind in Ireland so many years before she ever married him. The idea of him still living in the world and doing all the things he used to do, showering, shaving, snaking his belt through the loops of his pants, felt to Anne like a ripple in the space-time continuum. $5,231 was all that remained of their life together. All those years of commuting to Montefiore and rushing to deposit her check on Friday afternoons. All those years of sweeping the front porch, keeping the hedges straight and trim and presentable. She withdrew $4,000 to buy a used car. She knew better than to complain. With this, she had a ride to work without having to wait for a bus. She had a place to be by herself. And she'd made her own bed, as her lawyer once said to her. He'd had it with her by then. Irene House was meant to be a one-year arrangement, but when the year passed and no one asked her to leave, she'd stayed on. But now, Margaret told her that her bed was needed. They'd taken a look at Anne's file and said she was more than capable of living on her own. She'd not had any sort of alarming episode in her time at Irene, and at least part of that was because she no longer had to count out daily pills and tablets that she might choose to take or to push through one of the little holes in the drain of the women's showers, depending on her mood. Instead, she got a monthly injection, and ever since that change, she'd felt steadier, less haunted by the feeling that something bad was always about to happen. Anne had never lived alone in her life, and when she returned to her room after their meeting, she sat on the edge of her bed, the corners neatly tucked in the military style, and tried to catch hold of the fear she felt rising in her belly